We wish you the best.
Thank you so much.
The KABU Community Radio Artists in Residence Program application period is open. Every year, one artist or one collaborative group of artists will be awarded 20 hours of studio recording and production time with a KABU mixologist in order to create a piece of sound art that will be publicly presented at the end of the residency. The Artists in Residence Program is open to artists of all disciplines whose project proposals include sound as a major component. Applications for the KABU 2017 Artists in Residence are due Friday, April 7th. More information can be found at kabu.fm/kabuair2017.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Steve Early Lecture, taking place Sunday, March 19th at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Steve Early, author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City, will speak and discuss his book regarding the transformation of Richmond, California, from a fossil fuel-dominated town to one of the most progressive cities on the West Coast. Again, that's Steve Early, Sunday, March 19th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1121 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from The Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW.
Belly, need some drink for the dry in my throat, need for the world to recognize it, everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away just because it ain't the right size.
Welcome to the KABU Food Show. I'm your host, Chris Siegel. At the end of the program, I'll be talking with Joni Cooper, president of the Home Orchard Society. This Sunday, the Home Orchard Society is hosting their annual Fruit Propagation Fair in Canby, Oregon, where you can exchange scions, witness fruit tree grafting, and ask orchard experts your questions. I also have a short interview with Hector Jesus Flores Michel, owner of Mexico Latte in San Pancho, Mexico. Hector uses traditional processes when creating his products from cacao. I had the fortune to visit him at his shop in San Pancho this past winter. I'll also be joining the studio for our monthly garden conversation with permaculturist Marisha Auerbach. But first, like many of you, I am a lover of chocolate. If you have a sweet tooth like me, then you likely have a stockpile of chocolate somewhere. As I mentioned, I recently had the opportunity to visit a shop in Mexico specializing in cacao, and it opened me to a new world of flavor. The experience got me wanting to explore cacao even more. I reached out to Sebastian Cisneros, chocolate maker and owner of Coconut here in Portland, to talk about cacao. Sebastian has run Coconut since 2009 and created his first bean-to-bar chocolate in 2014. Sebastian, thank you for joining me on the Food Show.
Thank you for having me here.
On your website, you share a charming story about an early cacao memory. Could you describe your first interaction with cacao?
Actually, that's one of my earliest memories as a child in relationship with cacao. I was born and raised in Quito, Ecuador. Spent most of my life there. And as a kid, I would remember having family trips down from the Andes down towards the coast. And we would transition through this cloud forest and then hit the lowlands. And in that region, it's very common for cacao farmers to bring out their fermented cacao beans and let them dry on the side of the road. And where you're traveling through there, sometimes the pungency and aroma of freshly fermented cacao would just come into the car, I would remember, and it was very intense and confusing for me. What was the most confusing part is that my family would giggle about it, and they would try to tell me that somehow that turned into chocolate later. And they didn't know exactly how the process was, but it just created this big sort of mystery box in between that lived in me for a while.
What was that? What was that smell like?
Now I have a different appreciation for the smell. But I would say it's very fruity. It's like fermented ripe fruit, very intense and tropical.
And what do you remember about chocolate in Ecuador? You say that it was, you know, you that was the first time that you had to make that connection between eating the chocolate and the cacao that was growing there. Well, what do you remember about that, the chocolate that you were eating in Ecuador?
I was eating lots of candy. Had a big sweet tooth. I still do. And my earliest thought of chocolate in Ecuador was this candy bar that actually still is a white chocolate. I think it has a different name now, but it used to be called Milky Way. And I had no idea what that meant then. Now I do. But it had Rice Krispies, and it was a white chocolate and had a cow on the wrapper. That was my favorite chocolate as a kid.
And what is it about chocolate that's made you dedicate so much of yourself to it?
Well, it has changed my relationship with chocolate, especially since I started working with it. And as time progressed, it's become very representative of who I am as a person, and I'm very grateful to the impact it has had on me, especially because most of my family still resides in Ecuador, and through chocolate, I have the fortune to go visit them, and not only my family, but it's a place that I treasure and that I miss, and at the same time, it allows me to now communicate and share what I really value about it, and how I can express myself through it with the people who care about it here, and allow me to meet new people and widen my community and learn from people here.
When you were in Ecuador, how close were you to cacao, or what was your relationship with cacao?
When I was in Ecuador as a child, I wasn't often exposed to it. It was later until I started to delve into the whole process of it in around 2007, when I understood more about cacao, was more involved with it and saw it and saw the fermentation process and the drying processes, but I didn't grow with it. I grew in the Andes, and cacao doesn't thrive in high altitudes.
Gotcha. Well, let's talk about that process. So you were an enjoyer of chocolate, but then you made the decision to become a maker of chocolate. What was that process like?
So initially, when I launched Cocanu in 2009, I was breaking down chocolate, and it was manufactured in Switzerland, really good chocolate, and incorporating an addition of different flavors to give it my own sense of identity to those bars. And when I started, I already had the urge and the desire to transform cacao beans, but at the moment I felt that I didn't have quite the technique, I didn't have the equipment and the experience. So I knew how to do it, and I was already doing it at home, but I just didn't feel quite right sharing it with people, because I just thought that my execution wasn't up to my expectation. So it took me until 2014 while I felt comfortable and I had the pieces in place to be able to share that with everybody.
Well, it's definitely it's a strong flavor that you kind of have to you kind of have to tame. You have to be able to really integrate it without it overpowering. But I find this interesting. So you went from becoming a chocolatier mm-hmm. to a chocolate maker. What's the difference? When you're dealing sure. with chocolate, what's different about those two things?
So those differences have a larger contrast when you're in the industry and what you try to. People who don't know, they just think of chocolate people that work with chocolate. And I think in the end, it's pretty much true. I mean, that's what it is. We both work with chocolate. The difference with a chocolate maker is that they have relatively more control over the flavor because they can start with raw cacao beans and roast them and refine them and temper them. And actually chocolatiers get to temper too. But chocolatiers often use chocolate that's been previously made by either a manufacturer or a maker or someone else and try to elevate that good to a different place. And I think that itself takes a very high level of skill, especially if you're trying to deliver something exceptional.
So without, you kind of mentioned it a little bit, but without giving away your trade secrets, can you tell us about the process of making chocolate from the raw cacao?
The process of transforming cacao beans to chocolate, I think, starts at the farm. Starts at where they're being cultivated in. I would say that a big part of the impact of flavor comes from there. I don't have, unfortunately, any sort of control over that right now. But currently, I receive dry cacao beans. I roast them just as you would roast peanuts, coffee, just different temperatures in different settings. But you just heat them up to develop flavor in the bean. And then you have to remove the shell, because they're covered in a shell, and the inside of the bean is what you grind together with sugar or not. And it through the grinding process, it becomes liquid. And throughout a longer period of time, it becomes smoother and it becomes tastier into a process called conching, which is it's not very well defined. Still sort of an abstract term in the industry of chocolate making, but in essence, throughout the long period of refining and agitation of the chocolate, it goes in this stage for more than 70 hours, it evaporates, exhales many acids and becomes more tame and more the body of the chocolate improves, and there's some nutty flavors that kind of tend to come up that initially, if the chocolate would be too acidic, doesn't. And not just only this in the flavor part, but also it becomes smoother. And that's the sort of the beginning part of transforming chocolate. And then it gets tempered, which means you through variance in temperature, the chocolate becomes the cocoa butter within chocolate, within cacao and chocolate, because cacao has about half cocoa butter, half solid matter. In the tempering process, you restructure the cocoa butter, so when it hardens, it becomes really brittle and shiny. That's in short the process of making it.
For listeners who have just tuned in, you're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. I'm talking with chocolate maker Sebastian Cisneros, owner of Kokonu here in Portland. Where do you source the cacao?
I currently use cacao beans coming from Bolivia, from Madagascar, from Ecuador, and Venezuela. I've had the fortune only to be able to be present in one of these origins in Ecuador, and I've become familiar with the place where it's being cultivated, the people that are taking care of the cacao. But for the other and three origins, I actually just been able to receive samples from different people who are actually doing a wonderful job now around the world, seeking and trying to source wonderful tasting cacao. And I've been able to decide from then which ones to bring in to the factory.
So you get cacao from different places. I imagine they each have sort of different qualities. How do you differentiate the cacao?
That's one of the first wow moments that I had with fine chocolate, was to be able to have a significantly different experience of flavor based on where each cacao bean came from. And the place where I learned this was here in Portland, actually, in Cacao, a chocolate shop in Southwest Portland, who they are very, very careful about educating the public. And they were able to show me how different countries had an impact on flavor. Different origins created different tasting chocolate. So yeah, you can taste there's a significant difference, which makes it real that the origin and the genetics have an impact on how it tastes.
How do you come up with flavor and concepts for your chocolate bars?
The process is a little bit abstract sometimes. Sometimes it's very just real and this just tastes good. But for the most part, the way that I construct my flavors begins with an idea, with a concept or a memory about a certain place or a personal sort of experience, and then I try to use that as the catalyst to find flavors that would sort of mimic or represent that moment, and in a pleasing manner, because I think that at foremost I want to be able to share chocolate that tastes good. And if I can do that while connecting the dots of what my mind thinks sometimes, that's what I think. It makes me happy. So that's usually how I go about. One example is a chocolate bar that I make that it's infusing Palo Santo wood from Ecuador. It's a wood that is traditional down in the region, and it has a different sort of like cultural / spiritual value to it. But I wanted to, but that the scent of it, it's very nostalgic to the place of where I grew up in the Andes in Quito. So I found a way to infuse it into the chocolate. And that way it just kind of preserved that sort of idea of place.
I want to talk about that idea of sort of tradition, place. It seems like that cacao has deep cultural meaning. When you work with cacao, does it seem like you're connecting with any of those traditions and cultures?
I think that my work with chocolate does have a big influence on tradition, and tradition that has changed throughout time in many, many ways. We can go back centuries, and I have no idea, just based on my little knowledge of cacao history, is that, you know, it was first used as a drink by the Olmecs, and it kind of got discovered through colonization, and then it went to Europe, and then it transformed from a drink into a solid in the Alps. So we do take those sort of traditions from, like, just those memories. It's like, okay, cacao came from here, and then this is how it developed, and it was able to yield in a different way, and now we're presenting it in this form. And in the future, I think that one of the things that I noticed that may happen with cacao and its sort of appreciation is that it will expand on beyond just its nowadays sort of fine chocolates related to a solid. I think that maybe we'll start seeing cacao being thought of in a different way, for example, as a beverage, and expanding on the sort of like initial sort of use and tradition from a long, long time ago.
So it's kind of that cycle. We're kind of going to cycle back to, right, when you think of cacao, we think of chocolate bars right now.
Right.
But pretty soon that thinking will expand to the traditional uses of cacao.
I think it has the potential, and I can imagine it will have a lot of more correlation to what happened in the past.
Sebastian, we're about out of time, but what do you want to accomplish with Coconu?
I think that one of the most exciting parts about my work with chocolate, it's allowed me to be relatively free with my creativity. I would like to be able to push its limits, and I would like to be able to educate. I think that that's one of my biggest goals, is be able to share it with the public more of what I do.
Sebastian, thank you so much for joining me on the Food Show.
Thank you.
That was Sebastian Cisneros, owner of Kokanoo here in Portland, Oregon. For more information about Sebastian and Kokanoo, head over to the Food Show page on the KBOO website. You're listening to the Food Show on KBOO. As you enter the shop, you are greeted by the buzz of a blender, the bitter smell of roasting cacao, and an imposing man behind the counter.
I'm Hector. I'm a Mexican guy, and I live in San Pancho.
I've walked into Machico Latte, a chocolate shop in San Pancho, Mexico. At Machico Latte, they celebrate everything that is cacao. Hector guides me through all of their products.
With the roasted beans, we make the cacao water, hot chocolate, cacao lob shot.
They also sell a variety of chocolates.
We have raspberry, strawberry, coconut, chile habanero, chile chipotle.
And for dessert?
We have the vegan brownies, chocolate mousse.
For Hector, learning about cacao and opening the shop isn't just about making something that tastes delicious. He sees the making and consuming of traditional cacao products as a way to access history and culture. He opened Machico Latte because he was inspired by people who process cacao the old way.
And in Chiapas, I learned with the local women, with the Indian peoples, how make the cacao, and they roast, they peel them, they make water, chocolates, and I say, I want to do that in San Pancho, no?
The first thing Hector has you do when you walk through the door is to try a roasted cacao bean. The bean is large, dark, and bitter tasting, but has a very pleasant nutty flavor. It looks just like a coffee bean. Hector describes the process of transforming raw cacao into the roasted bean.
We bring the beans from Chiapas, the process when we open the fruit, we take out the beans. So we need to ferment it first for maybe 5-6 days. Then we put in a dry zone. And then the store we roast in a mat pot, like in a traditional way. Then the local women's here in San Pancho peel them.
Hector sees skills and traditions being lost all around him. He has recently begun to provide cacao for a group in Mexico who use chocolate in their ceremonies.
They offer in blood for animals, tobacco. They have their own tobacco. They call macuche. They offer tequila, candles, and they offer chocolates, no? Also, like in the past. But they offer sometimes Hershey stuff, no? And
eventually, Hector would like to grow Machico Latte. He is currently looking into producing his own cacao so that he can have an even closer relationship with his product.
We have an experiment with 1 acre with cacaos. Our vision is like has our own herbs, no? But
his shop is small, but Hector sees a grand future for cacao. To Hector, every time someone tastes one of his products, they tap into Mexico's rich culture and history. Eat a Machico Latte chocolate and you are transported to another time. I pressed Hector about his favorite way to eat cacao. He told me he prefers the raw beans.
I always eat the 5, 6, 7 beans before surfing or before bicycle. The beans, for me, is the best way to get the real flavor.
That was Hector Jesus Flores Michel, owner of Machico Latte in San Pancho, Mexico. To learn more about Hector and Machico Latte, you can visit the food show page on the KBOO website. In a moment, I'll be joined by Marisha Auerbach for our monthly garden chat. You're listening to the food show on KBOO. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. I just got back out into my garden this past weekend, and it was glorious. Of course, it was a mess from the wet weather that we've been experiencing this past winter. When we have nice windows, there's a lot to get to in the garden in order to maximize the harvest for the coming season. To talk about that garden to-do list, I'm joined by Marisha Auerbach for our monthly check-in. Marisha, welcome back to The Food Show.
Thanks, Chris. I'm glad to be here.
And I do want to say, Marisha, thank you so much for coming in. Marisha just got back from a trip, which I want to first ask you about. So it's probably going to make all of our listeners jealous, but could you tell us a little bit about Belize?
Yeah, I just got back from Belize last night. I teach a permaculture design course in Belize every year. It starts at the end of February and goes to the beginning of March, which is right at the end of their rainy season. I work in deep in southern Belize in a on a farm that's 28 acres, and it's only reachable by a dugout canoe. So you've got to get to the nearest Mayan village and find our dorymen who has a canoe that's made out of guanacaste that's been hollowed out, and he takes you up river to the farm. All of the food from the for this all the food for the course comes from on site. And this year we had about 36 students. We get a wonderful grant from Lush Cosmetics that makes it possible for all the Belizeans to take the course for free. So we have about 3/4 of the class is local Belizean people. This year we had mostly Mopan Mayan students. Sometimes we have Quechi. We also have Garifuna students, Mestizos, Creole, people from all over Belize, which is a really diverse country.
And what were some of the things that you guys talked about it and or I mean I'm assuming got some hands-on experience with in this
Absolutely. Yeah, the curriculum for the course is the 72-hour permaculture design course curriculum, which is the same internationally, and that's the course that I teach online at Oregon State, as well as in person at Portland Community College this summer, and then I do 2-week retreat courses like this one in Belize where we cover all the curriculum. However, since this one's in the tropics, we focus more on tropical agriculture and design for tropical living and how to design for living in a space that has hurricanes, that has seasonal monsoons, that has lots of insects, designing for the wildlife they have. Belize has the most amount of wild cats of anywhere else in the world. They have 7 different types of wild cats. And it's a really interesting space to be. They have a really high environmental ethic in Belize as well. And the people that I work with in Belize are very keen observers of nature, which is one of the primary things that we look at in permaculture design. And they know lots about how to use all the different wild plants. There's a rich culture of medicinal plants in Belize, and how to use all the different edible plants as well.
And I want to get to our gardens here in the Pacific Northwest, but we've been talking about cacao on this show, and you were in Belize and you got some firsthand experiences with cacao. Could you tell us about some of the traditional Mayan methods of growing cacao?
Yeah, well, I work in southern Belize is where the traditional Mayan criollo cacao comes from. There's a Mayan ruin practically on every person's land. It's amazing. There's huge civilization that used to be there, and the Mayan people that still are there are the descendants of these people. Mayan people traditionally grow cacao in a stacked polyculture, which is what we usually talk about as far as sustainable agriculture in permaculture design. So the overstory in the forest will have the overstory palms, which includes coconut, cajun nut, and the peach palm. Then you've got nitrogen-fixing trees below that, such as the Inga edulis, known as the ice cream bean, erythrina, lucena, guanacaste. Then the overstory trees underneath the nitrogen fixers include bread nut, breadfruit, jackfruit, mango, citrus, cinnamon, allspice. And then in your understory trees, you've got coffee and cacao, often grown in similar ways. Often there's also vanilla or black pepper that's growing as a vine in these forests. And then the understory includes cocoa yam, pineapple, cassava, turmeric, ginger, cardamom, and other species that we love like that. They honor the wild animals as well that live in the area, and they have these intentional forests that also provide forage for wild animals, knowing that the wild animals help spread the seed of these plants that they love very much, and attracting the wild birds to help with the health and fertility of the plants as well.
That sounds like an amazing landscape, but I do want to bring it back to the rainy landscape of Portland. So in the last week, there have been a couple days where I was able to get out into the garden, and mostly trying to clean up and get organized after the wet winter. How do you approach the garden at the beginning of the season, and what are some good ways to get organized so that you have a solid approach?
Well, the first thing I like to do is revisit my map. And I have a nice base map that I made on my property, and I like to look at it, see what I planted last year, how can I do my crop rotation, and re-fertilize the beds and just fluff them up and get them ready for being able to have a great growing season ahead. I'll look at the different sectors, the offsite influences to my design, and the various microclimates as I plan out what's going to go in. You know, now as the soil's starting to warm up a little bit and it's time to put the peas in, we want to give the peas one of the warmest places in the garden since they're going to be one of the first crops.
Are there any other considerations for where we plan to put plants when we're looking at our garden layout?
Well, it's worthwhile to think about where the wind comes from and how that might impact your plants. I like to do a stacked stadium seating approach orientated to the south so that the levels in the garden increase in height as I move to the north to make for the most amount of sunlight in the garden.
And what are some things that folks can do in the way of prepping the garden beds before planting?
Well, making sure that your garden bed is dried out enough to work the soil is a crucial first step. Also, it's good to add lime in the springtime to help sweeten the soil and prevent it from getting too acidic. Adding compost before planting is really helpful. You can do that about 3 weeks before you plant. I tend to just top dress and then let the soil critters work the compost in the soil.
So I know you just got back, so you haven't had a chance to check the conditions in the garden, but are there any plants that we can get into the ground now?
Well, I know those peas can go in right now, and mine I planted just before I left, and they're starting to come up, although I do need to do a replanting. We can plant in perennial vegetables. I will need to check the soil temps to know for sure if we're ready for the brassicas, but within the next... You know, before I come on the food show again next month, we'll be able to get the broccoli and the cauliflower and the cabbages in the ground, our kales, some of these cool season starts, onions and chives. So it might be that those could go in now. But like I said, I just got back last night, so I'm not too tuned in with what the temperatures have been over the last 2 weeks.
And that kind of leads to my next question. How much do we need to think about weather and temperature as we're starting seeding and planting?
I think it's really important. You know, often people will start selling tomato plants way too early. I don't want my tomato plants to be anywhere outside until it's 50 degrees. The brassicas are more cool weather tolerant, but we want to make sure that they don't freeze, and you want to do your best to be able to have your plants have a really successful life as a young plant so that they can produce the best possible vegetables for you.
For the plants that we do have in the ground right now, what are some things that we can do to help them get established?
Well, anything that's ready to start producing, like, you know, if you have an overwintering kale or chard, all of those things could use a nice top dressing of compost or manure. That'll give them an extra bit of nitrogen to help add to the soil fertility that's been lost with all the rains of the winter.
And we're about at the end of this segment, but what events or classes do you have coming up in the near future?
Well, my once a month Grow Your Own Produce workshop series is on Wednesday, March 22nd for this month. We're going to be focused on early season planting, seed starting, and the Brassicaceae family. I'm also doing registration for my Vegetable Starts CSA program, where my subscribers get one flat of vegetable starts every month throughout the growing season to help them stay on track with planting in the garden. I'll start having plant sales in the beginning of April.
Excellent. Marisha, we're so glad to have you back stateside and back on the food show.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be here.
That was permaculturist Marisha Auerbach. For more information about the classes Marisha offers, you can visit her website, permaculturerising.com, or head on over to the food show page on the KBOO website. In a moment, we'll be talking with Joni Cooper from the Home Orchard Society. You're listening to the food show on KBOO. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Chris Siegel. This coming Saturday, the Home Orchard Society is holding their annual Fruit Propagation Fair in Canby, Oregon. To tell us more about that event and the Home Orchard Society, we've got Home Orchard Society President Joni Cooper on the phone. Also, Marisha Auerbach, who is talking garden with us, is going to stay on and talk some more with Joni. So, Joni, welcome to The Food Show.
Thanks, Chris. Hi.
First off, I want to get a little bit of the history of Home Orchard Society. What's the mission of the organization?
The mission is to teach people about growing good fruit in their yard. That's really the basics of it.
And what kind of support do you offer the amateur orchardist?
Well, we have a membership of almost 700 people, and a lot of them are local in our area. We have two events a year. Our Fruit Propagation Fair is this coming Sunday, and then in the fall we have our All About Fruit Show. But throughout the year, we have different events at our Arboretum, and we have classes, and so people have different opportunities for learning about growing fruit in their home.
Could you tell us a little bit about the Home Orchard Society Arboretum? What can people expect to find who visit it?
Okay, it's almost 2 acres. It's on the campus of Clackamas Community College, and we grow just a little bit of everything. We have apples and pears and plums and cherries and small fruits, and we have edible landscaping, and we demonstrate different sizes of rootstock and different techniques of growing. We're putting in a new row this year of apples with the spindle technique, which is a different way of pruning your trees for a small area. And so they can really have a good visual opportunity to see, oh, that would look good in my yard. And our Arboretum manager, Tanya, is terrific. She's really smart and is very willing to offer any suggestion and help somebody would need when they come and visit us.
So it's a great resource if people have questions.
Yes. If people have questions, they need to stop and see. Now, they're open on Tuesday and Saturday, 9 to 3. So either of those 2 days, people could stop in and visit with her, have all their questions answered. They can see how the different ways of pruning and different techniques. So it's a really good opportunity to learn.
And how do people get involved with the Home Orchard Society? How do you get new members and volunteers?
Okay, you can go online to our website, Home Orchard Society. You can sign up, become a member online. You can, when you come to the Fruit Propagation Fair this Sunday, which is in Canby, you can sign up, become a member. If you join and become a member at that time, then you get in for free. And we have a quarterly newsletter called the Poem News, and it's a really terrific publication. It gives you the things that you should be doing in this quarter of the year, and tells you all about what we're doing and gives suggestions for your home or things that you should think about, and answers lots of questions.
Great. So I want to talk about the Fruit Propagation Fair. Now, I haven't been, but I've heard a lot about it. It sounds like a really exciting and active event.
It is. It's really fun.
What can folks expect to find at the fair?
Okay, when you walk in the door, it's busy and buzzing because there's a lot of energy. People are having a good time. We sell rootstock of all kinds of sizes, and we give away hundreds of scions, which is what you need to graft onto the rootstock to make a tree of your choice. We have experts there that can counsel you, tell you what you need to grow, make suggestions for your yard. We have plants that are for sale. We have some a commercial nursery, One Green World, will be there. We also will have a couple of other commercial booths, so there's opportunities to purchase. And we have a special section where you can get your tree grafted right there that day, and you go home with this little baby tree.
No, I'm in the studio with Marisha, and I know Marisha's gotten to participate in this event. Marisha, do you have any thoughts on it?
Oh, I love the home propagation fair. It's amazing how many different varieties of fruit you can get a scion for, so that you can grow just about anything that you want. There's lots of kinds of rootstocks. Most of the members come in the fall to the fall show, so they can taste all the different varieties of apples and pears. And so then they look forward to coming back to the spring show when they can revisit their notes and look at the varieties that they enjoyed most, and then be able to get those scions so that they could bring home trees of those varieties.
That's a good opportunity for someone who's a beginner, because there are people there that have a lot of expertise and are really knowledgeable for someone who's just starting out with a new yard for them.
I volunteer every time in both the fall show and the spring show, and it's true. I've learned so much by working with all the different people at the Home Orchard Society. I volunteer just so I can learn more.
Well, Marisha is often a speaker at our fall show, so lots of people learn from her.
So I have a question about grafting specifically. This is more kind of educational, but you're going to be grafting on site. Could you give us a little bit of a background on why you graft fruit trees onto specific rootstock and how the grafting process works?
Yes, you need to decide how big a tree you can have in your yard. Is it going to be 10 feet? Is it going to be 15 feet? The rootstock that you select makes the decision for you. This rootstock is going to produce, say, 10 feet tall. And the experts will be able to tell you which one to select. Then you're going to take a scion. Now, a scion is a cutting off of a mother tree. And that determines what variety tree you're going to end up with. You have to graft it onto a rootstock to get that same variety that you like. And this grafting technique, it attaches this cutting, this scion, onto the rootstock. It's a grafting method, just the same as they graft roses or any other kind of a plant. Then you carefully take this baby tree home and nurture it in a pot. And these two pieces of wood are actually growing together. The cambium layer on the rootstock and the cambium layer on the scion, they kind of meld together, and you end up with this wonderful little tree. Does that answer the question?
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much.
So
this kind of popped in my head. How many varieties of fruit trees do you think are going to be at the fair?
We will probably have over 200 different apples. We'll probably have 50 different pears. I mean, plums, pears, probably about 50 again. We don't have so many this year as we normally do. And there'll probably be, I don't know, 10 or 12 cherries. Often we don't have as many of the stone fruit, the cherries and the plums, because a lot of people prefer to bud their stone fruit trees in the summer. And so, but there are some there. You can be successful doing it this time of year.
So I have a question. A lot of what kind of really intrigues me about the day is the scion exchange. Could you tell the listeners exactly what a scion is, and how does that scion exchange work?
Okay, scion exchange is not the right, that's kind of a misnomer, it's not the right terminology, because in the olden days, the people would just bring their clippings off their tree, and they would trade. And we've gone long past that. Nobody brings anything in for trades. But the scion is last year's growth on the mother tree. It's the little end that comes out on the branch that was last year's. That's what we use to graft onto the tree. That's the scion.
Great. And before we move on from talking about the propagation fair, could you tell us where and when the fair is happening?
Yes, it's in Canby at the fairgrounds in the main pavilion. It's right on Highway 99. You'll see the great big sign that says Clackamas County Fairgrounds. You can't miss it.
And we'll
hours
have...
are 10 to 4.
Perfect. And we'll have more information on the KBOO website as well. If you just tuned in, you're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. I'm talking with Joni Cooper, president of the Home Orchard Society. And I kind of want to shift a little bit, and you've also been busy establishing the Temperate Orchard Conservancy. Could you tell us a bit about that project?
Yes, we started that about 5 years ago with the specific challenge was to copy the largest private collection of apple varieties in the United States, probably in the world. And we have been working at it each year to save and preserve these heirloom varieties. It's kind of interesting. There is kind of a resurgence in interest in saving heirloom varieties of fruits and vegetables. So we have a farm out of Malala, and 40-acre farm, and we have been grafting since 2011. Every year we graft a portion of these heirloom varieties, and we've got this coming year, this fall, when they go dormant, they'll go in their permanent location.
And why is it so important for you to conserve all these different varieties of apples?
Well, if you think about it, if you don't have kind of a wide genetic base for anything, for any variety of fruit or vegetable, you could be in real trouble. I use the example of the Irish potato famine. You know, they wouldn't have been in trouble if they had had more than one variety of potato, because disease affected it and it went through all of them. And so they lost their whole crop. The reason for selection, diversity, is that you won't be affected by disease or happenstance because it's only affecting one variety. You've got lots of varieties, and they each one carries different properties. Some are more vulnerable to certain diseases. Other ones do well in wet climates. Other ones do well in dry climates. So they all offer different advantages, and you need to keep that base. It's really critical that we as a country, we as a world, have this base to draw on. Right now, the apples that are in the supermarkets have a base of about six different mothers, and that's really scary, because if you lose if a disease kind of starts into one of these base varieties that they're using for everything, what are you going to do? You're going to be in trouble. So we are hoping that with our collection, we will have it available for breeders, for nurseries, and eventually we want it available so we can offer programs for the schools in the area so kids can adopt a certain group of apples or pears or whatever, and monitor them, collect the disease information, the ripening, all this sort of thing. You have apples that ripen in summer. You know, apples that ripen in the fall, some that ripen in the winter, some will store really well, and other ones will not. You know, they're a very short window. So there's so much to offer. If we lose that, it would be tragic, and we're losing our history.
So I imagine every year you're probably trying to bring more and more varieties into the orchard. Where are you finding these newer varieties of apples to increase your base?
The original purpose was to copy this massive collection that's down in Yonkawa. The gentleman that has it was older and was having medical problems, and so he said, you know, we need to do this. But we do explore old orchards. We get calls throughout the year, would you like to check out this old abandoned heirloom orchard, this homestead that has the remnants of an orchard, and there's a few fruit trees left. And so we do exploring and trying to identify varieties that we find. So, yeah, it's kind of an ongoing project.
What do you find is the most challenging thing about creating and caring for an orchard?
Oh, golly, that's hard to say. It's there's several things involved. You have to kind of be aware what your ground is. First of all, you want to know is it going to support the fruit trees that you're putting in there or whatever plantings that you're putting in it. And you have to monitor for diseases. You've got to prune so that you're keeping your trees at the size that are workable for you. And that's important.
So we are coming to the end of the interview. And I just want to talk, you've dedicated a lot of your life to these projects that involve fruit and fruit trees and orchards. What is it about it that inspires you so much to dedicate so much work and energy to fruit trees?
Oh, golly. Well, a long time ago, I bought a farm outside of Amity, and I was delighted because it had the remnants of a very, very old orchard that was planted in the late 1800s. And it just piques my interest. I picked these fruit, and I didn't know what they were, and so then I had to pursue the experts at the Home Orchard Society. I had to become acquainted with them. To try and identify what I had, and it sparked an interest. So I've had an interest for a long time, and I enjoy sharing my interest, and I enjoy other people getting excited about growing fruit in their yard. This is important. Fruit tastes so much better coming off of your tree in your yard. You don't pick it till it's ripe, and that's not the case when it's in the supermarket. So I think it's kind of contagious, and it carries me.
Great. Before I let you go, Joni, one more time, could you give us the details for the Fruit Propagation Fair this coming Sunday?
Yes, the Fruit Propagation Fair, Home Orchard Society. It's Sunday at the Clackamas County Fairgrounds in the main pavilion. That's just right off Highway 99 in Canby. You can't miss it. And the hours are 10 to 4.
Joni, thank you so much for joining me on the Food Show.
You're welcome. Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was Joni Cooper, president of the Home Orchard Society. For more information about the Home Orchard Society and the Fruit Propagation Fair, you can visit the Food Show page on the KBOO website. And that's it for this episode of the KBOO Food Show. If you missed any of the show or want to listen back, you can find the episode archived on the KBOO website at kboo.fm. I want to thank our guests, Sebastian Cisneros, Joni Cooper, and Marisha Auerbach for being on today's show. I also want to thank our AM Public Affairs Director, Derek, for stepping in and operating the board. Stay with KBOO this afternoon, starting with Jazz Lives, and don't forget to tune in again next month, the third Wednesday of April, for another episode of The Food Show. Until next time, I'm Chris Siegel. Thanks for listening.
When their families could be growing food, working those lands for corporations. Don't do hungry people no good, 'cause people need food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat, need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry. Everybody's in the same hole. Don't you know it ain't right to cut the trees down just to grow a bunch of cheap hamburger meat? You know those trees, they hold the topsoil, and those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government who protects them. Tax dollars where they need to be, 'cause people need food in their belly. They need some drink for the dry in their throat. They need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Got to have food in their belly. They need some drink for the dry.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Gaining Ground, a documentary film by Elaine Velasquez and Barbara Bernstein. The screening is Thursday, March 30th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center. Gaining Ground is a film about growing food, empowering communities, and changing lives. It also addresses the negative impacts of industrial agriculture and genetically modified foods. It is an intimate view of rural and urban farmers embracing challenges. Again, that's Gaining Ground, Thursday, March 30th at 7 p.m. at the Northwest Film Center, Witzel Auditorium in the Portland Art Museum, 934 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.